If you'd like to leave your thoughts on this interview or ask our gurus a question, visit softwaresecuritygurus.com or leave us a voice message by visiting anchor.fm/softwaresecuritygurus.
Welcome to the Software Security Gurus webcast with Bunkin Tijani. Welcome, Bunkin.
Thanks, Matthias. Thank you.
Bunkin, it's great to have you. Can you share a few words about yourself?
I'm happy to. Yeah. So I'm Bunkin Tijani. I've been in, you know, I think of myself really as an engineer that became a security person. I grew up as a tinkerer. I always like to take things apart and build them. I learned to program at a pretty young age and worked up from there. And then I transitioned in my career from software development into security. And so that pathway is kind of informed a lot. And then, you know, that's where we cross paths later on in that journey, where I moved over from InfoSec into application security and, you know, got to be with you and many other great people at Fortify and in the early years when we were a startup, and then going through the acquisitions. And then I've been since then focused on cloud security, product security, and now really helping, you know, to keep pushing that forward and modernize.
An engineer that moves into security. These are the best, right?
I think so. I think we should all be that way. But, I agree. And I was listening to some other episodes and I fully agree with Flea, right? I hope that all security people are also engineers, right? It is awkward that we talk about security engineers but don't have an engineering background. But I'll say something a little bit more controversial. I also think it's awkward that we call software engineers engineers when we're not professional engineers, right? Like, if you build a building and it crashes because you built it wrong and you were defective in your materials or you're defective in your components, or, you know, you lose your license. Mm-hmm. You're liable for that. And when we look at software, that's not the case. We don't have that teeth structure to accountability in our industry, not just in security and software security, but also in software engineering in general and software products. And so that's, I think, an untold aspect of the picture. And so especially when you talk about recent things like SolarWinds, right, we're really, there's all of these things happening and we're seeing like the bad things can happen, right? But clearly the bad things did happen with that. But because it happened with software, there is no liability, right? There's no impact of that. And so you can effectively push out insecure software at will, and there are very few consequences, right? Like, no one's lost their CISSP or their CSSLP, right? But if you were an architect on a building that collapsed in a nefarious way, you would lose your license, or you'd at least be liable for malpractice. And, you know, so that those are things that don't happen in our industry.
I do think it's going to change when, you know, software is more and more embedded in our systems, like cars, airplanes.
Yes.
And if it's over there and people lose their lives, I don't know. I think that's a different thing. If it's just software, if it's the World Wide Web and a SaaS solution to do whatever thing that is only on a computer and it stays on a computer, that is different from real life things. So I agree with you, but I think there's going to be changes because
I think there will. Everywhere. Yeah, and certainly things like self-driving and lots more that will drive the impact of that. But I also think, you know, the amount of technology and in medical devices, and, you know, these are areas where, you know, there's lives at stake. And so, you know, we do have to be better. We have to write better software as an industry, and we have to hold ourselves accountable better for that.
Absolutely. And that actually needlessly goes into my first topic that I want to touch on, which is, back in the day, we were at the company, which was really good at finding problems in code. And the more problems you could find, the better. The mountain of problems, you know, and then we wanted to find them faster, more categories, more everything.
Yeah.
I think right now we take a different stands on it. It's not about how big is the pile, how many can we find, but it's more like, hey, how can we build better software? As you're saying, how can we fix that? How do you see that? How do you see that transition? And maybe if you can talk a little bit about your company organization and how that transition happens within your company.
Well, I should probably qualify. So currently I work for Charles Schwab, I'm the chief security architect there, but I'm not representing Charles Schwab in any way on today's call. Nothing I'm talking about is from Schwab. My experience, like you said, when we were at Fortify in the early days, right? You could run a scanner like that, and you still can today, right? You can run a static analysis scanner, you can run a dynamic analysis scanner on almost any application and come back with hundreds of vulnerabilities. And so when we were there at Fortify, that was kind of like, our professional services program. Like, we could scan anything, right? Any application you want, and you're going to get somewhere between 100 and 1,000 vulnerabilities, depending on the size of the application. But any sufficiently large application, you'd come back with hundreds of vulnerabilities and do it. And so we knew, had that confidence, and we could only get better. Like you said, we could only get better. And so much of what the security industry focuses on is, well, help me find the next thing, right? Help me find the next set category of issues and what they are. And I think it's funny because you look at the OWASP top 10 and, if I go back, 2004, 2007, and you look at the different years, not that different, right? Like, they've repackaged them a little bit here and there. They've collapsed one or two into a higher level category. But at the core, you're still talking the same sets of design patterns. And so, and we're still finding them, right? And so there's something there to that. The other piece that I recognized, and at that time, in that early mid 2000s, late 2000s, really was the security team that was buying these tools and saying, okay, we need to use this because we don't know what's happening. There's these applications over here. They're very complicated. We don't know what's happening. We don't have the expertise, right? We're not developers. We run networks and we run infrastructure. Yeah. So I don't know what's happening. I need a tool that's going to tell me what's happening and what's good and what's bad. And then I'm going to kind of smack this report down on a development team and say, hey, go fix these things. And what I found, spending years working with our customers, a lot of financial services companies and government agencies and startups, that ethos really was, okay, we find these vulnerabilities, now we're going to flip them back to the development team. They're going to go fix them. And one example organization, I won't say who, their average time to fix one, just a single finding, was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 60 to 90 days, right? Well, what does that mean? If you find 1,000 things in your application and you do the math, right, you're never getting out from under that. You will never get out from under that at that velocity. And so you have to really think about this differently of like, okay, what can we do to change this model? And there were reasons for that, right? Like, there are reasons for, because it's a separate team that is providing the results and a different team that's receiving them. They're not talking the same language. There's disagreement about things like false positives, false negatives, right? Like, these are, so you lead to these areas of long-term negotiation and this was all happening via email. Now it's happening via Slack, but it doesn't matter, right? The point is you're not spending time fixing, you're spending time communicating and arguing about what you should fix. And so we have to find ways to accelerate that, but also to create more ownership. And so, one example, kind of scenario, it's a customer that we went to, they had this paradigm, right? And they were 60 days to fix one issue. And so we went in and said, okay, we want to change this. We want to do it differently. We're not going to follow that same process because we want to show the value of doing it differently. And we said, okay, let's go with three development teams. And what we're going to ask of these development teams is that they fix 20 issues within 30 days, right? Within a month, they're going to fix 20 issues within 30 days. And the development teams, they were like, whoa, this is a lot. Right, you're asking us to do all of this at once, and the security team was like, well, that seems too small, but we'll try it, but we still don't think it's going to happen because it's going to be too long. And we said, okay, you know, we're going to change the way you engage. We're going to change the way you communicate. And rather than you giving them a report and says, here's what you have to fix, we're going to give them the direct information, right, to actionability. But we're also, you can't dictate to them what they fix, right? We need them to have agency in what they choose to fix and what that is. And so we set those ground rules, everybody agreed. And we sat down and we did it. We did training. We showed them how to use the software. But more than anything else, we actually showed the developers their code. We're showing them their own code, mm-hmm. their own flaws. And then we said, okay, what can you fix? Right? How can you use this and change it? And so, you know, and they set aside 30, you know, a month worth of man hours to do this across times three teams. In the end, they actually spent, I think, I forget the exact numbers. There's about 10 to 12 man days mm-hmm. across the three teams. So they were planning for a man month each, right? So three man months. And they went, the actual time they spent was about 12 man days. Mm-hmm. And what they actually fixed across the three teams was, I think it was around 120 to 130 vulnerabilities.
Very nice.
Right? Because what they found was once they cut through the noise and the back and forth ping pong between different groups, what they actually found was, oh, I can make my code better. And you know what? This thing, that's the same design pattern. I already know how to fix thing. And once they learned it and they applied it and they had the right motivation to do it and they had the planned time, right? That was the other piece of it. They actually had time planned where they had set aside this resource to do this work. And that's not the typical model. The typical model is, well, you know, when you think of a developer experience, you get your stories from Jira, from your product owner, and you develop and you build it, you test it, then you move on.
Yep.
And then a month later, somebody comes along and says, hey, we found this issue with this code that you wrote a month ago. Well, now you have to go carve out new time and then go back in your mental energy and go backwards a month to where was I, what was I doing, what was I thinking? And so that doesn't work, right? We have to find ways to get that information to the person at the right time, the right actionable moment. But we also have to be more respectful about the relationship and the agency, right? And I think of this in a lot of sense. Like if you go to your partner, right, and you say, you know, there's 100 things I don't like about you, right? How's that going to go in terms of a dynamic, right? That's not going to go very well. It's not a productive way to build a relationship. But that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. We're dropping down findings and you know, issues and risks. And we're saying, hey, go fix this. What's wrong with you? Why haven't you fixed these critical issues or these high issues or these medium issues or these low issues? And that's not the right approach. We have to create a different structure where they have agency, but they can also turn those things into planned work mm-hmm. where they can take ownership of when it's done, how it's done, and actually build that into a schedule. And I think there's really great thinking around the industry around this, right? So SREs talk a lot about tech debt and the idea of like a debt clock, right? Where once you accumulate a certain amount of tech debt, like, now you have to stop feature work to do that and a defect clock. And I think we can take similar approaches with security, right? And having that. And other really great approaches to create planned capacity. Right, set aside 10-15% of your sprints and negotiate that up front and say, okay, 10-15% is just set aside to do security defects, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And if you get to a place where, hey, you've fixed all the security defects, you get 10-15% time back, right? Which can be for both. Like it's not, you're not taking away and like returning it. It's still set aside because if something happens later, it's still set aside. But if you get yourself, if you engineer your way ahead of the curve, now you've got bonus time,
more time
that you can spend on it on the feature that you know your engineers really want to do, but your product manager doesn't necessarily want to prioritize. Right, so you can mess with that in lots of ways, but you can create these incentives for teams to self-actualize what they want to do. And I think on the whole, right, engineers, developers, even we as security people, we want to do good work. We want it to be valued. We want it to be useful. And so we have to find ways to tap into that ethos in the way that we engage from software security to our developers.
Yeah, absolutely. And developers want to do the right thing. Actually, in your experiment, there's a couple of key ingredients, I would say, that made it successful. So there's for sure a cultural shift in terms of, hey, everybody has to rally around security. You make it a top priority. You acknowledge that they need time to upskill themselves to make sure that, hey, they need to make sure they can fix this. And
you
brought the two teams together. That didn't happen 10 years ago either. As you were saying, people were throwing security issues over the wall. You gave them time. You had the right setup. So actually what I hear is there's a lot of key ingredients there in that experiment that made it successful, and that people that hopefully listen to this need to copy into their organization to do something successful and bring people together, rally around it, and actually get
I think there's a lot of aspects to that. Yeah. And it took that, it took work, you know, it was a team effort to drive that. Yeah.
Then Bunkin, I have a second topic, and I'm actually very, very curious how people live through a breach. And fortunately or unfortunately, you lived through a breach.
I did.
So I would love to hear how it feels like from a personal experience on, you know, how do you live through a breach? Because people tell me sometimes, you know, it's hard. And then they've heard from somebody that knows somebody that it is hard. But you've lived through it. So I'm very curious.
Yeah, I lived through it. So, you know, this happened in 2018 when my Fitness Pal was impacted. So at that time I ran product security for Under Armour Connected Fitness, which included my Fitness Pal, Endomondo, Map My Fitness, and then UA e-commerce. And so one of those properties had this breach, and we went through that. It went public. It was a very difficult thing. I can't talk about all the specifics because of company info, but certainly the personal experience of it was breathtaking. I mean, in some ways, right? I mean, it changes so much. But I'll go back to beforehand, right? So even before then, years before, I'd seen data breaches, I'd seen Target, I'd seen what happened with TJ Maxx and so many others. And I always felt bad for the people that were affected, but hoping, you know, it never happens. And when you even just in your dialogue, when you talk about things, it's like, oh, well, this could happen. It could be bad. We could have a breach, right? It's this like ominous thing that occurs, right? And is the end of the world. And then it happened to us, right? And I remember the day that I knew that it happened, because we, you know, we'd gotten some information from a security intelligence company that, hey, this might be something that's affecting you. And it was a Sunday, I remember, because I went to go play hockey. I started a download, a big file download before I left. I went to go play hockey. I play ice hockey. And so I went to play my, you know, beer league hockey game. I came back from that, and the data download had finished, and I started looking through, and I was like, oh fuck, this is our data.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, okay. And then the rest of that week, you know, from that Sunday night to, you know, Friday, I think I slept maybe 20 hours, right?
That's
total
crazy.
In that time frame. So it started right away. We, you know, knew it. And there were some things I learned from that, right? That were really, really valuable. I mean, one is scary, right? I mean, like, I don't know, right? I mean, okay, does that mean I'm fired? Like, I don't know. And that always kind of occurs as I think a possibility. But in truth, it really didn't. That was an unfounded fear, right? Because what I learned, one of the things I learned from that experience is that it's not as much the thing that happened as it was what you did. Mm-hmm. And what we did was pretty amazing. Right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you look at the data, the average disclosure time from the time you know something happened to the time you disclose to the public is around 33 days, give or take, on average.
Yep.
And there's some that are much longer than that. We went public in 4. Right? So that was a Sunday that I kind of found out and then we're going through. We went public Thursday. Right. That was the whirlwind. That was fast. And that was a team effort, right? It took a ton of collaboration. And and also the relationships that I had built there over the previous 2 years that we had built collectively between the security team and engineering. We were embedded in the same offices and sitting together. Our customer support apparatus, legal, the privacy in particular, our communications team, you know, all the engineers, and so many more, right? I mean, even technology and corporate risk and all these different functions, and having the right things in place, you know, having vendors that are on retainer for forensics and outside counsel that's on retainer and ready to go. Like, we had all these building blocks in place. But then it also took a tremendous amount of collaboration for 4 days, right? To get ourselves in a row, to have answers, to have a diagnosis, to really drill in, to, you know, stem any damage and make sure and protect it. And so all of that was a huge thing. And one of the things I took away from that is the fear is so much worse than it seems. And the actions you can take are so much better, right? Like, ultimately, you know, no. Was it a good thing that we got breached? No, of course not. But when we look at what happened, what we demonstrated was we had the utmost care and concern for our customers. Okay. And we took all the right steps in terms of a response. And I think we even got called out by some of the consumer data regulators as like, this is the way you should respond to an event like this. And so is it great that it happened? No. But you know, what did we learn? So much. And we learned, you know, having those relationships is so critical. I found this is one of the key elements of a talk I gave at LastCon kind of afterwards about it was one of the key killers, killer things that made us execute that way was Slack. Because we had adopted a Slack culture. And so we did so much of that collaboration in Slack, right? In private channels and, you know, and so little of it was on email. And the driver for that was, that's just how we were collaborating. But it was so evident afterwards when you look back and do a retrospective, that made us so much faster because each day when new people got read in and say, hey, here's what's going on, how can you help? Right. They had a very clear history of what to go through. They didn't have to go get forwarded 50 different email threads and then have to digest it all. It's all very linear. It's very clear. Yeah. Here's exactly what happened. Here's who's doing what. And here's what's been talked about. And now as soon as when I ask questions, it's ramping up. And so when one person asked questions, the next person that came in got the benefit of those questions. And it wasn't starting over each time new people were brought in. So all of those things helped us to automate that way. And we had a lot of other infrastructure. We had great engineers. I mean, brilliant engineers are with us to help scale and automate. And they were also there with us, you know, night and day through that week. And so it was a team effort, but I feel like one of the things I took away is to be less scared, yeah. Right? To not let that fear drive us. And fundamentally, I learned that, you know, we couldn't, there was nothing really we could have done earlier to prevent that earlier. I mean, it's bad that it happened, yes. But when you look at the landscape, that's not the end of the world. And so, chasing perfect security isn't, I think I didn't have a great sense of perfect security beforehand because I'd lived through it enough with Fortify and everything else and seeing what was out there. But I also afterwards have a more resolved view of like, I'm not chasing perfection. What I really want to chase is, do we have the right dynamics? Yep. Have we set up the right incentives so that our developers can be their best and take the best decisions? And are we empowering our security people to do that? And are we not being driven by fear? But are we being driven by the customer? Are we being driven by the value that we're providing and making sure that we're delivering their risk expectations, our risk expectations, and doing it. The only system that's zero risk is the one that's off. And if it's off, you're out of business. Yep. That's not a place you want to be in, right? So it's much better to take risks and be smart about it than it is to try to strive for zero risk, because I just don't think that's feasible.
Yeah, I think so. What I hear is you must have had a very well prepared team. You're actually doing whatever you can to prevent something like that. But even then, there's a plan B, or there's a backup plan that if something goes south, you are prepared. And the Slack one I had never heard before. And actually, it makes perfect sense that a solution like that, or a communication mechanism like that, where you have the history, where everything is in, that makes perfect sense how that can help in circumstances like that.
And that there's also the, you know, we were talking about culture a little bit before. There's a cultural aspect of it too, of being able to connect and bond and drive that. And that drives that communication, right? And having that connectedness was really important. And you know, we've done that from the beginning. I mean, my you know, effective CISO at the time at Under Armour, Brian, was so amazing at embedding our team with the engineering work, right? That's something he wanted to do from the beginning. And that's where, when I came in to drive that focus, that's what we did. And so that set the groundwork for everything that we did later, because we were all together, right? We were on the same team. The security team wasn't separate from the engineering team working on different goals. We were on the same set of goals.
What I also read is that there's a lot of openness and transparency, not only to the outside world, but also internally. Because, you know, if I hear you say like you add people to Slack channels and stuff and you can read up on the history, there must be a lot of transparency, which then helps in resolving.
It does.
And the communication part. Bonkim, we're coming to the end of our session, and I actually have one more question.
I'm waiting, man. I want to hear the homework that you've done.
Yeah, so you're one of the people behind Lascon, right? And unfortunately, it's not going through in 2021 and 22. And for the people who do not know what Lascon is, it's the Lone Star Application Security Conference for builders and breakers, from application developers to security engineers. And you're one of the people behind that. So congratulations on that. It's a fantastic conference. So my question for you is like, hey, you've had some great, so the speakers make the conference, and you've had some great speakers in the past. And I was actually wondering, who would you like to have on Lascon? And if you said, well, we already have had everybody on Lascon that I ever dreamed of, like, who is your top speaker that you think of that would fit perfectly within Lascon?
Oh, man.
Except for yourself. Question. I know you've spoken yourself. You can't pick yourself.
I can't pick myself. Oh, that's a great one. Well, I'll drop a plug for Lascon and the OWASP Boston chapter. Right? So I've been involved and volunteered with Lascon since 2009. Mm-hmm. And it started out of the Austin chapter of OWASP and has been shepherding it. I was lucky. I was a volunteer for a number of years, and then I was able to step up into the conference chair position for a couple of years. And actually just last year, I stepped away from the conference chair because of, you know, we had a toddler and wanted to spend more time on that. And so I actually stepped away, and then it turned out, you know, because of COVID, we didn't have Lascon 2020. And so I hope we're going to come back and be stronger in the future and with it. Who would the speakers be? Oh man, that's great. Well, I'm going to preface this while I'm thinking about it. Some of the really great speakers that I've gotten the privilege to meet and get to know over the years, you know, Gene Kim stands out. There's so many more. Shannon, Wicket. I mean, you know, some fantastic people. But who would I love to see there that I haven't seen already? You know, there's one in particular, and that's Sean Carpenter. And it's going to sound interesting. I don't know if you know him or have seen him or met him. So and I'm going to say it for a couple of reasons. One is because he was kind of a role model for me very early in my career. He was, at that time, we were both at Sandia National Laboratories, and he was actually my customer. He was one of the people that got me interested and aware of security as a profession. Prior to that, I just knew of security as like a hobby. And so he was, you know, this whirlwind of energy, tracking down security for the Sandia National Laboratories, which is part of the laboratories, the nuclear weapons laboratories for the United States. And he was my customer. I was doing I was actually writing data mining software to identify network anomalies for Sean and for his team. And then since then, he's gone on. He was a key person at NetWitness and became an investor. But he was also became famous or semi-famous for Titan Rain, because during the time that I knew him, he was actually tracking a group of attackers, and you can look it up. Google Titan Rain, you'll see the articles. But he was tracking this group and actually discovered them, and then was able to kind of be a whistleblower and report them to the FBI and help protect many government agencies against continued attack by this group. And a bunch of things happened to him after that, but he really believed in what he was doing, and he just showed me this model of how to operate. And so I think for that reason, one being a role model, but since then, he was at NetWitness and did amazing things and has been an investor in security companies and an advisor to a bunch of others. And it's just really one of the most brilliant people I have ever known. And so that's who I pick.
Nice. So I really hope you guys come back with Lascom and it's going to be stronger than ever, and that you're able to get him to the conference.
Well, I'm hoping, now that this is going to hit the social medias and stuff, mm-hmm. and I'm going to tag him and hopefully he'll come down and give a keynote. That'd be awesome.
That would be fantastic. Yeah. So yeah. Duncan, thank you very, very much to be the 19th guru on the Software Security Gurus webcast. Thank you very, very much for this lovely chat.
Thanks. Good to see you again as well.
Thank you.
Bye.
Software Security Gurus is sponsored by Secure Code Warrior, the secure coding company.